Hi, it's Connor Svensson here, founder and CEO of Web3 Labs. This is a conversation I had with Daniel Fechtinger, innovation marketer at Digital Asset. Whilst his current job title may be misleading, Daniel is a technologist and true innovator at heart, having been the co-founder and CTO of Hyperledger, which he started back in 2014. In our conversation, we discussed the early days of Hyperledger and how the blockchain landscape evolved back then. It was mainly about Bitcoin and colored coins, as Ethereum hadn't even launched then. We also go into detail about how Hyperledger ended up becoming part of Digital Asset and Digital Asset's DAML platform, and his work leading the Interwork Alliance's Interwork Framework, an initiative by the Global Blockchain Business Council, which we're both involved in. Given that Daniel has been living and breathing enterprise blockchain for over 8 years now, he provides some great perspectives on the space, and I know you'll enjoy the conversation as much as I did. Hey, Daniel, it's great to have you here.
Hi, Connor, great to be here.
So a number of our listeners have no doubt heard of Hyperledger, which is now a Linux Foundation-backed foundation that hosts enterprise-grade blockchain software projects. However, what most people probably don't know is where Hyperledger came from, and it was once upon a time, back in 2014, a company that you started with Dan O'Prey. I'd love to dig into, well, what was happening back then, and what was it that made it come into being, and you know, where it went and how it ended up part of the Linux Foundation?
Sure. There's quite a lot to cover there. Feel free to pull me back in if I go off track. But I reached out to Dan back in early 2014, but it had been germinating in my mind, I guess, from 2012, 2013. So go back to blockchain in those days, it was all about the altcoins. You know, this is pre-Ethereum mainnet launch. This is, I think the yellow paper might have been out or something back in those days. There was Bitcoin, but then there was kind of, I guess, across 2013, there was all these altcoins. It was the era of Litecoin and Dogecoin and all that kind of Cambrian explosion. That was really interesting to me. Dan, I knew going back a long way. We'd been at school together, and he I knew was interested in Bitcoin. But I had a particular angle that was something I wanted to address. We didn't really have the terminology for it then, but to use today's terminology, I really wanted to build. I was most interested in stablecoins. So not necessarily just pegged to one-to-one to a fiat currency, which I guess is the most common form today, but could you build kind of synthetic currencies out of baskets of other currencies or commodities, and really have a platform that you could launch maybe dozens or hundreds of these different stable coins. Again, today that's a really pretty easy sentence to convey some information, but we had no terms for that back in 2014. We had to do some long-winded explanations to people. The problem was back in those days that there wasn't the infrastructure and options in blockchain that you had. It was pretty much Bitcoin or variants of Bitcoin. As I say, everything else was very early days. Ripple was around. It was still, as far as I remember, it was still closed source in those days. So they had an open source that was very centralized. Documentation was kind of all over the place. We weren't fully convinced that it was going to be an appropriate kind of building block for us. What we were really interested in was Bitcoin had colored coins and I think master coins, ways of kind of dropping other types of assets on top of Bitcoin using the op returns. But we had, obviously you had, and still do, the very long block confirmation times. And our hypothesis was if you wanted to build stable coins, they were gonna have to be, like particularly if they're pegged to something that trades very rapidly, something like a currency or basket of currencies. If you've got 10-minute block generation times, or you've got an hour that you wanna be waiting before you're sure about blocks, there's a lot of arbitrage kind of opportunities around that, and that it might be too difficult, too hard to really stabilize a currency on that infrastructure. Obviously today you've got a lot of options for doing that, but as I said, back in those days we didn't really have anything. So that was what we were interested in. A paper popped up by he's now a Google engineer, I think he was still then, Ben Lorry, kind of very well respected in the cryptography space, sort of criticizing some of the design details of Bitcoin, and particularly the kind of the proof of work scheme, and pointing out really that just there was this whole field of consensus protocols which had been developed in academia, and they had good throughput properties. They were very pretty well understood, and they had known kind of limits and trade-offs. And so that was kind of the technical underpinnings, kind of building off that paper. We started to research that and built out a very rough alpha and beta. It was at the time, I think, called Mintet, as in a little mint, which was in reference to I think, the Ben Lorry paper. But we relatively quickly rebranded to Hyperledger. And so through 2014, to the best of my knowledge, we were the first of those, I guess you'd now call enterprise blockchains, so kind of blockchains without any cryptocurrency built in. We did debate it. It wasn't something that we were kind of dead set on right from the beginning, but it just seemed like it was an interesting way to kind of differentiate ourselves, just blockchain kind of as a software platform, as a software abstraction, rather than mixing in the kind of game theory economics that you need around the kind of the token asset that if you're building something around a native asset. Broadly, I would say through 2014, as I said, we launched this alpha, launched the beta. I would say broadly, some interest from people. Some people kind of got it and saw it and wanted to build with blockchain stuff. Again, this isn't the industry of today. This was the industry of 2014. It was, and there was nothing like this at that time. So it was having to go and explain everything from scratch. And a lot of people kind of still, I guess, same dynamics as you see today. A lot of people kind of invested in the kind of speculative side of some of the coins, and so didn't understand why we were doing this just as a software abstraction, why we weren't building it on Stellar or Ripple or all those other kind of things that were going around then. Kind of bits of traction through 2014, but then I remember very clearly end of 2014, beginning of 2015, the financial banking sector really switched on to blockchain and the message. And in a matter of weeks, it was just crazy amounts of inbound, from big top tier banks and financial exchanges and all this kind of stuff. Suddenly our message of, this is just a software platform. This is just kind of building block to build particularly robust systems without kind of empowering a new central authority was very popular. So we got a lot of interest very, very quickly. We were in New York we were taking part in, I think it was Bank Innovation. I think it was something connected to Sibos, if I remember. This is unfortunately so many years ago now, it's lost a little bit, but we were in this competition. I think we went on to win it in the end, but we were in New York for one of the regional legs, and we ended up meeting a small startup called Digital Asset, at the time being based out of New York, being led by at the time Blythe Masters, who'd picked up quite a lot of press for the kind of prestige of their investors and Blythe's history as well. We went in for a meeting, which we thought was a sales pitch for them to kind of build their stack using Hyperledger. Ended up getting on really well with the team, and really thought there was a kind of a good fit there. Really liked kind of what they were building, and candidly, probably quite intimidated as well. That this was the caliber of people who were entering the space now. Up until then, it had been quite it was kind of the Wild West. It was crypto days. It was kind of a lot of strange characters, as it still is. But, you know, seeing kind of real kind of institutional money and people with a lot of experience come in, that kind of made us think that, you know, that this was possibly a team worth closely aligning with. And one thing led to another, and I think pretty rapidly they ended up making an offer to acquire us, which we accepted. So became part of the digital asset family in about mid 2015. The space that we had created, this kind of enterprise blockchain space, was still rolling on. It was different projects were launching, kind of variations on the Hyperledger idea, trying out. We had a very simple transaction model. We were very much built around his assets, his transactions. Other people were obviously looking at exploring the kind of EVM, route, with more kind of computation available on the network, but still keeping the idea of a kind of permissioned infrastructure underneath it. So we decided, we were still in contact with people in the industry, and predominantly, I wasn't so involved, but Dan O'Cray did a lot of the heavy lifting in kind of corralling all those various tendrils out in the market, and ended up reaching out with and speaking to the Linux Foundation. And we ended up donating the brand over, and a bunch of people contributed code. IBM contributed what they were calling open blockchain. It's probably the biggest chunk is now kind of the backbone of Fabric, although a lot of other contributors since then. I've been at Digital Asset then ever since 2015. Unfortunately, not so involved in the Hyperledger project anymore, but touch base now and again. It's good to see that it's still looks like it's going really strong, and a lot of interesting different projects in incubation there. It's exciting to see.
It's certainly a lovely legacy as well to be able to leave there too, with respect to having that name was part of the company that you created, and you were in the space so early on as well compared with most. I mean, even with previous people we've spoken to on this podcast, they were people who are looking at this technology ahead of the curve from a corporate perspective, and that was kind of 2016, 2017, and you guys by this point had already gone through the journey and been acquired. And so just going back to the Hyperledger Foundation, was that when it was first created, and this is more of a kind of curiosity point, did you have the Linux Foundations and IBM saying, hey, we want to create somewhere for blockchain projects, but it needs a name? Or was it more that there was like digital asset came along to these guys and said, hey, we've got this great idea for, we've got some open source we want to throw into the mix? And IBM, obviously, as you said, were keen to as well.
I think it's, I don't know if I can speak authoritatively on this. I think, it was really Dan O'Cray on our side, at least, who was doing a lot of the work here. I don't exactly know how it came together, I think it was, I think we'd ended up with the situation kind of having acquired, when Digital Asset ended up acquiring Hyperledger, ended up with at the time, we wanted to be neutral to the particular underlying platforms that we were supporting, and to reuse Hyperledger as a brand, I think, would have sent slightly the wrong signal that perhaps we were competitive or launching our own thing. I think it would have it didn't really fit in branding wise into what we were building with Digital Asset. But it did have a lot of cachet in the kind of the marketplace. We'd built a lot of credibility there. So I don't know exactly whose idea it was, but I think it was a relatively simple decision when it was offered. I think it was a kind of a no-brainer for the foundation to take it, and I'm glad they did. Yeah, it was always something that Dan and I wanted, that we were gonna hopefully one day. Obviously, what our mental model was back then was very different from what ended up being the case, but. At least something that was going to standardize around the protocol level, and have that in a really kind of openly governed foundation, and allow for different implementations of it. But yeah, couldn't have imagined something as large and vibrant as the current Hyperledger ecosystem. So really glad it's still going there.
Yeah, and it's definitely one of those things that's, you know, I'm not assuming that you fall into that camp, but as technical folk, you kind of aspire to having code and software that can be open and there's play, you know, people can collaborate on it as well. You know, there's the commercial interest, of course, but then it's nice when there's those opportunities to kind of give back to the wider community, albeit the technical community.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it's a natural place for it, right? This is, you know, hopefully the kind of the way it's heading, going to be a relatively core part of a lot of financial infrastructure. And it's not a level at which you want proprietary protocols and, you know, things that are locked up really tight. It was always going to have to be like an open source layer. But there's a difference between kind of just open sourcing something, right? Just we were always building open source, right? We just had a GitHub up and, you know, we were dropping all our code there. But there was no governance to it. There was nothing beyond that. And that's really what the Linux Foundation specialize in. You know, they have decades of experience now marshalling some of the biggest open source software projects. So being able to plug into their kind of governance models, legal models, all that kind of stuff. And particularly, you know, under the early stewardship of Brian Bellendorf, who was, you know, at the time, I think executive director, but leading the Hyperledger Foundation, had a lot of experience coming from the Apache Foundation to really kind of shepherd all these projects forward. So yeah, as I say, it's not kind of it's interesting to see, you know, touching into it. It's kind of, you know, there was a time when it looked quite kind of familiar to me. I was like, I kind of recognize all the pieces there. And now it's this kind of big greenhouse, I think they call it, of all these kind of projects they're incubating. And yeah, it's just interesting to see the breadth of solutions that people are building in this space.
Absolutely. And so moving on to digital assets, DAML's one of the core products of digital assets. And their approach by, you know, creating that library is kind of different to many other platforms insofar as they've created, in effect, a ledger agnostic language for designing smart contracts and performing multi-purpose computations. Would you be able to just tell us a bit more about what it is about DAML and that sort of approach that's always sort of appealed to you? Because it's something that they didn't obviously start off there, but it's been something that they've been doing now for a number of years, and it's kind of one of the core offers there of it.
Sure. So I mean, going right back, you know, we didn't have, when we joined Digital Asset, it didn't have, I'm trying to think, 2015, I still think this was pre, you possibly remember better than I do, pre-mainnet Ethereum launch. I think that was slightly later in 2015. And this idea of kind of smart contracts was floating around, you know, the Ethereum white paper had been published and people were obviously talking about it. I remember there was still a lot of chat about like how much you could fit into an 80 byte op return code on Bitcoin. You know, was that going to be scalable? Was Ethereum really going to offer that much, you know, on top, or was it just an over-engineered solution? So these were, you know, going back, it was a very early time, and it wasn't exactly clear as to how much on-chain logic you were really going to need versus, you know, just using the blockchain kind of as a commitment mechanism, which still is a pattern you see today. People just kind of doing off-chain transactions, hashing them or hashing well-known states or documents or whatever it is, and just committing them to something like Bitcoin. These were really early, you know, it was really early, very early kind of technical questions. And our particular focus, given our kind of origins and our work with kind of systemically important financial institutions, market infrastructures, banks and other things like that, has always been privacy. So that's kind of been, I think from the early days, a lot of the architectural decisions that we were making was really, that was kind of the, obviously there were a lot of others that we wanted systems to be reliable and robust and scalable and all these, you know, obvious things, but privacy was the one that was the biggest challenge, because it's kind of in contention with the consensus protocols where you need to federate out, you need to, you know, gossip out a lot of data and, you know, get a lot of nodes to kind of agree to it and kind of, you know, go through whatever consensus mechanism it is, proof of work or more traditional kind of consensus protocol. And so there is a tension there. And I think that was one of the guiding things that kind of ended up culminating in DAML. So the origins of the language were actually in a Swiss company called Elevance that was acquired by Digital Asset in 2016. And they had been building this programming language for finance. I would say they were building it kind of from the top down, from the language, kind of how are you going to describe all these like very complicated financial contracts. And, you know, they hadn't yet got down to the level of kind of building out the infrastructure around it, kind of connecting it to blockchains or, you know, figuring out kind of integrations into other systems and stuff. And Digital Asset at that time had been going a little bit differently. We'd been building infrastructure, you know, all the kind of the various pieces, a lot of hard coded stuff at that time, because again, we were still using the blockchain as kind of a bit of a, you know, sort of a, because we wanted to be so private, we weren't kind of contributing too much logic on chain. So it was a lot of kind of off chain stuff and then kind of making commitments onto the chain. But we were realizing the kind of the fragility of that approach. Not having on chain smart contracts was certainly becoming a sticking point. We wanted to add new asset classes or something that's kind of, you know, whole new blockchains and compatible things. And it was raising a lot of questions. So the acquisition really kind of, you know, I think, was very nicely dovetailed the kind of the two approaches, and again coming in with our kind of the privacy focus was so essential. And you know, the DAML's approach that we kind of, that, you know, as the teams were kind of meshing together and figuring out how we're going to kind of square all the various kind of technical artifacts and how we were going to particularly with the minds that we had to solve all of this with privacy as well, I think it was you know, this very elegant solution kind of fell out. So it's a, you know, it's a very interesting language. I encourage anyone to go and take a look at it. It's open source. You can download it at daml.com. And it's kind of a Haskell inspired language. So it's a functional language. It's got a strong static type system. It's pretty approachable. I've got a lot of developers who are kind of, you know, very focused on the developer ergonomics of it. So it's a really nice language, I think, to write, because fundamentally what you're trying to write, smart contracts can get very complicated. There can be a lot of sophisticated pieces in financial models, financial workflows. And so, you know, you don't really want the language to get in the way of trying to express a business problem like that. And particularly, I think the most important thing, kind of really what I think differentiates it from something like Solidity, which is a great language, you know, Solidity's, I think does some stuff really nicely, but fundamentally very different execution models. I think one of the reasons that we ended up going the DAML route and not the kind of the Solidity route, which was floating around back in 2015, was that we didn't see any way to add what we needed privacy-wise into the kind of the EVM execution model, that model of kind of contract as objects with messages flying between them, didn't lend itself to the kinds of privacy that we needed. And so DAML, fundamentally under the hood, this isn't necessarily something you're thinking about as you're programming it, but it's a bit more like the Bitcoin system. It's a bit more of a graph of transactions with states getting created and kind of consumed over time, kind of like the input output model of Bitcoin. And what that means is that then you can reveal just kind of very select parts of the graph to say a stakeholder, to a transaction. So it's just a bit more fine grained on the privacy aspects. It's been interesting to see the kind of the different development paths, because obviously Solidity's got a slightly different focus and some really interesting tooling around it, really interesting applications being built in it, but it's kind of two different tools solving two different types of problems. So it's good, I think, that the industry has kind of got multiple solutions there, depending on, there's nothing worse than, you know, only having one tool in the toolbox and trying to use that to solve every class of problem, even when the problems fundamentally have kind of different attributes.
And that was something certainly that struck me back in the a few years ago. I'd hung out in some of the functional programming communities before and seen, got to know some of the faces, and suddenly started seeing a lot of these people turning up at Digital Asset working on DAML. And so it was clear that you guys were hoovering up a lot of really good talent there in order to actually build out the platform there. So it's no doubt got some really solid engineering behind the scenes there. Just touching as well, a lot's changed right since 2015, and nowadays we have these things like zero knowledge proofs and roll ups and these various other privacy approaches. Do you think that if we were where we are now back in 2015, it could have changed the path that you guys took? I appreciate it's something that you didn't necessarily decide for Digital Asset, but I think more as a kind of thought experiment, because certainly where we are 6 years later, the landscape is very different to where we were back in 2015.
Oh yeah, I mean, if we had some of the things available to us back in 2015, I think we would have made a completely different set of decisions. I think it's every kind of engineering technical decision like that is going to be situated in the kind of the current context of what's possible. One thing, I mean, I'll say, we were always very, one of our founders, founding CTO, Shal Kafir, was, he was one of the, I think he was the lead on the LibSnark project prior to Digital Asset. So a lot of kind of experience in zero knowledge proofs. And it's something that, just to take that as, one of the examples that you mentioned, it's something that we've always kind of kept a close eye on. And we certainly have lots of ideas about how how that could come to bear on kind of the technical architectures that we're building. The trade-off has always been the interesting thing to me, perhaps coming from a bit more of a software startup world, where you're kind of you're building and managing your own services, and you're just using it, whatever the kind of the most appropriate thing, even if it's something cutting edge or a bit a bit rough around the edges, but you're taking on that risk yourself. But trying to build out infrastructure for financial institutions, you have to maybe make a slightly different set of trade-offs, and so you maybe naturally have to sit behind the curve a little bit, and probably wisely so. There's been some, just to take an example, the Intel's secure enclave stuff, is it SGX? Momentarily forgetting the name. It's got some interesting possibilities, but again, something we looked at and kind of have a stance on, and very aware of kind of what it can do. But at the same time, there's kind of periodically been some pretty major issues found with it, and so sitting a little bit behind on some of this stuff can be a wise strategy as well. Particularly not making a too aggressive a commitment to it. So I think just from an engineering point as well, you end up with something that's quite robust. You're using very well understood primitives, particularly in something like cryptography, which can be where you can really shoot yourself in the foot. If you go off the beaten path, then you're opening yourself up to a lot of potential problems. And so if you just stick to the kind of best practices and very simple primitives, and build with that in mind, you're going to end up probably with a very kind of simple, robust core. And then you can focus on, the real kind of 90% of the engineering work being the production readiness of it, the scalability, the monitoring, alerting, the plugging it into different, platforms, and, all this container stuff has obviously exploded over the last few years as well. And that's what people are kind of expecting to use. So, there's all these kind of like engineering concerns on top of just the core technology pieces. So I think that's, yes, we would have built things differently if the world, was today what it, if we had back in 2015 some of what we've got today. But at the same time, I think maybe the bulk of it wouldn't have looked too different because, you know, it would have given us a leg up. But I think where we've ended up is in a space where our architecture is appropriate, makes sense for the solutions that we're trying to solve. So unless we were solving a different problem, I think the architecture wouldn't look too dramatically different.
Yeah, absolutely. And so what are some of the other initiatives that Digital Asset is focused on? Because DAML is just, you know, it's a key product, but it's one of the, you know, key products that Digital Assets provides.
Yeah, so we're an enterprise software company. So that is, DAML is a kind of our core. It started off it was just the language. And I guess I've been speaking about it as a language, but you quickly realize these things don't always quite work. So it's really, if you think about it, DAML is a runtime platform. So it sits on top of different storage backends, whether that's a blockchain or a traditional centralized database. And it has a runtime kind of data model, the ledger that it's building. And obviously the shape of that ledger, the schema of that ledger, if you will, is kind of determined by the DAML models that you're loading up. So really that's the kind of, it's a platform for building, running, executing these multi-party applications, kind of smart contract based applications. So we have then a couple of the core of it's open source. You can grab it, download it, run it yourself. But enterprises typically want a little bit more than that. So we have enterprise packages available with, you know, additional enterprise features and things like enterprise support, which come along with it. And we also have a managed service called DAML Hub, which is for many people, they want the kind of the benefits of being able to build. It's kind of like the kind of blockchain as a service kind of pieces, but a little bit different. We're focused kind of really just on the application layer. So the idea is you're not building in a kind of very low trust environment where you need the kind of the blockchain consistency, tamper-proof kind of properties. You just want the benefits of being able to work in a multi-party kind of application using a smart contract language, which is built for writing financial workflows or, you know, trade workflows, these kind of things. You really realize that you can get a real speed benefit building your application using the appropriate tools. We've got this managed solution as well, which is a rapid way of building and deploying these applications.
And certainly one of the things that seems to have come up before too is the flexibility of the backends is quite a powerful thing, because some organizations, although they start off thinking they want to work with blockchain, then they come across some of the most ledger based database technologies like the AWS
QLDB.
AWS is QLDB. Microsoft have recently released a similar blockchain-backed SQL Server, basically, and that sort of flexibility, no doubt, is of great appeal to certain organizations for certain classes of problems.
Yeah, exactly. I think that was one of the things, again, that we would probably have taken. That's probably something that would, a lesson that I would like to feed back to my 2015 era self. We were so focused back in those days on the consensus protocols and this, you know, how do you build very trusted systems out of kind of lots of loosely, you know, perhaps mutually distrustful parties running each their own nodes, because that seemed to be a key piece of the kind of Bitcoin blockchain story. And it certainly is. But there's kind of two levels. There's the infrastructure layer, which is how can we build these blockchains, these kind of, I think of them as databases now. I didn't like it for a while, but now I do. How can we build these very kind of decentralized databases but still build them in a trusted way, even if they're built out of lots of kind of little kind of non-cooperating, loosely cooperating parts. And then there's the kind of the application level, like the smart contracts and building with that, and the types of interfaces, things like the ecosystems that you can unlock with like ERC20 or ERC721. You know, that's a kind of a whole separate level. That's kind of just like engineering things. How can we build a service? How can multiple people just throw code into a service and build, you know, this whole ecosystem, which isn't just going to constantly collapse on itself? And that's kind of a separate question. That's kind of a building at the application level. And so I think, you know, when you kind of decouple them, you realize, okay, so we've got this kind of this way of building very highly trusted databases, highly trusted machines that are still very decentralized. That's really interesting. And then we've got a way which is building really easily these kind of multi-party applications where a bunch of people can just upload new logic to it, new smart contracts, and kind of constantly enrich this service as an ecosystem. And if you decouple them, then you realize, okay, well, we can actually run, yeah, it makes sense to run the multi-party applications on top of highly trusted networks sometimes, but they're slow. And, you know, there's overheads, a lot of overheads when you deal with them. And in some cases, we just want the benefits of building that kind of code ecosystem, smart contract ecosystem. And we can just run it on a, you know, we can just empower a central party to just run this infrastructure. So I think it's being able to take your, you know, being able to take the benefits of those applications and just deploy them to whatever infrastructure makes most sense for you. Because even within that category, right, you get different of the, say, the blockchain technologies, you get different, you know, permissioned or permissionless infrastructure. And within those, you get different throughput rates. You know, there's different technologies, different trade-offs, different privacy models. And so if you kind of tightly couple all the way up and down the stack, then you're just, it's as an industry, you're not going to move very far, because everything that you do, you know, imagine if you had to, you know, pick your programming language and that also determined what kind of CPU you were kind of committing to run on in production. It would just be a, you know, nothing would ever move anywhere. You know, you wanted to change language and then you had to rip out your data center or change your cloud host to use a different type of CPU. It would just be too tightly coupled. So being able to, you know, separate the two pieces and run applications as you want is a where you want them, I think is a very good way to kind of ensure that the kind of you know, the industry can kind of keep building the solutions that it needs to and keep making technical progress as well.
Yeah, we certainly don't want to be back in that place you were with C and C++ where you're compiling it for certain target architectures.
Exactly. Yeah. Now, the downside, of course, or the so, thing that the next piece that you need to solve there is how do you end up? Obviously, then you've kind of got you're just kind of changing. You're just building different islands, right? So the idea is that we want to get rid of all these different silos and kind of build around blockchain architectures so that people can build these kind of these interesting multi-party applications where you've not just got little silos of data and little kind of narrow bandwidth interfaces kind of just in and out of them. You're actually building like full fidelity models that anyone can kind of contribute code to and, as I say, kind of end up in this collaborative process. But I think where the industry is currently kind of is kind of at the moment, we've left open the problem that we're just building bigger silos, bigger islands. We've got all these kind of proliferation of enterprise blockchains, even public blockchains. There's a lot of them, and they're not all kind of, you know, there's some interesting efforts to kind of make them slightly interoperable, but I really think that's going to be, if I'm looking ahead to kind of the next era of this blockchain technology, I think that's going to be something that really needs a lot of work, because right now I think it's kind of holding back the ecosystem as a whole. If everything that you're deploying to is going to be, you know, stuck in to just committing to one instance of a particular blockchain network. I was trying to find out the other day, you know, how many different deployments of something like Fabric are there, even a loose kind of estimate. And I couldn't see, you know, how many different Fabric blockchains are there out in the wild. I mean, maybe IBM have done some research on that, but I couldn't find any kind of public information about, you know, what people thought. But back of the napkin calculations, I reckon it's thousands, tens of thousands. And that's a lot of different infrastructure, which I think is going to need some protocols, some infrastructure, whatever it might be, to really make sure that those are interconnected, not just that they work nicely within themselves.
Yeah, and there's certainly interesting things happening in the public domain with Ethereum in that respect, because of all these other protocols are starting to promote Ethereum, well, EVM support, basically, so people can run Ethereum contracts natively on them. And so whether that ends up being a de facto standard for public blockchains certainly remains to be seen. But it's it's certainly a fascinating time with more and more blockchains coming forward to say, yeah, we support these contracts.
Go on. Yeah, I was just going to say, like, even beyond the kind of the EVM piece is good, absolutely, that we can kind of have the same execution semantics across different blockchains. But I think even stronger than that, we want some way of kind of synchronizing the actual runtime state of different blockchains. And I think there's a few things out there. There's kind of different, obviously, Cosmos and its interblockchain protocol and stuff like that is out there. I think there's still a lot of work to be done there, and we're hoping in the new year that Digital Asset we'll be publishing a little something in this space, so that we've been working on, hopefully going to help kind of move the whole industry forward there as well.
Cool. That'd be exciting to see when that comes out. So one of the other things that you're involved in, and this is certainly something that the two of us have spoken about a fair bit over the last 18 months, is the Interwork Alliance, which is obviously now part of the Global Blockchain Business Council. But you are the chair of the Interwork Framework Working Group, and I'm obviously the vice chair there. But what was it about the goals of the Interwork Alliance that kind of pulled you in? And certainly for our listeners, the Interwork Alliance is a standards body that's focused on creating standards for multi-party compute type business scenarios. And the Interwork Framework is the part that's focused on smart contracts, or whatever you want to call them.
Yeah, so I mean, it's I guess there's two angles to it. So firstly, the Interwork Alliance had some previous form, in that one of the kind of precursor elements into it was the token taxonomy. I think it was the Token Taxonomy Initiative became the Token Taxonomy Framework, which was a very comprehensive effort to take this kind of Cambrian explosion of different tokens and different types of tokens and definitions to try and kind of build a specification or a framework that could very simply kind of explain the core elements of tokens. So you could kind of have a common language to talk about all tokens, and then a very precise way of specifying, but I mean specifically a non-fungible token, which, of which there is a fixed supply and that, they can only be transferred five times or something, adding on these kind of modifiers, but still having a kind of a common language of being able to talk about it. So the question is really, how do you take, given the kind of a plethora of tokens, how do you kind of apply a similar approach to the next layer up, the smart contracts, if you will, or the multi-party applications, whatever it is that's governing the tokens in these movements? Another piece, just kind of as the kind of motivation was written, was to try and avoid, I think, something you touched on earlier, which was, how do you stop what quite of a lot of companies have found themselves doing is picking a particular blockchain architecture first, perhaps because you have vendor relationships, and so you pick a particular platform, and then find out it has certain properties, certain limitations, or certain benefits, or does one thing and not another. But you've already committed to it. You've started your business process of kind of specifying the problem that you want to solve, but finding that it's somewhat incompatible with the technology, or letting the technology modifying your solution to a suboptimal solution so as to fit the technology that you've kind of pre-committed to. And so if we can kind of reverse that and say, okay, we want to be able to talk about kind of general properties of smart contracts and multi-party applications, and kind of have a way similar to the token taxonomy framework of being able to describe the properties of what we need out of to solve the particular problem that we, the authors, the developers, need to solve, the business needs to solve. And then we kind of have a rigorous way of understanding, do the technology platforms we have available to us make sense or not? How can we kind of help guide that decision? So I think that's something that we very often found at Digital Asset. We deal with a lot of companies who come to us having started down one particular path and then realizing that they kind of need to back out, which is why one of the good things about Daml is that it's portable. So, you know, you can kind of keep the properties that you need from the language level, but then, you know, pick the infrastructure that you perhaps have already committed to, you perhaps have operational experience deploying. So that's something that we're very familiar with at Digital Asset, and something that we're really hoping to kind of standardize to spread across the industry at large beyond just a, you know, our particular vendor solution there.
Yeah, so it's certainly be good as seeing those goals fulfilled over the coming years.
Yeah, and it's certainly, I do remember first seeing the charter and kind of the scope of what the IWA wanted to achieve there and thinking, you know, this is ambitious. This is really far out. But you know, I think it's the sort of problem that we're chipping away at. And you know, first thing that, you know, you and I did, sat down for a few months, and just really sort of figured out, you know, what's the art of the possible? What today, without inventing anything, you know, what are the ways that we can kind of talk about this and reasonably in a way that would cover both something like Daml and something like Solidity and some of the other languages out there, without kind of you know, dropping too much information? How can we kind of describe all these things consistently, but acknowledging that they do have differences?
Yeah, absolutely.
Long way to go.
So
more work.
Yeah, exactly. So it's going to keep us busy for years to come. So if people want to kind of keep up to date with what you're up to, or, you know, engage with anything, you know, where you're present online or whatever else, what are kind of the best channels to reach you? You've obviously mentioned Digital Asset as the company there and their website and where Daml's found. But what about yourself if people want to contact you?
Yeah, I mean, pretty much Twitter is the backbone of my web presence communication. So you can check me out. My handle's Auxilit, AUXILIT. Yeah, I tweet some blockchain stuff these days, but it's kind of tech at large. Yeah, you can always reach me there. Drop me a DM if you want to get in touch.
Oh, awesome. Well, Daniel, it's been an absolute pleasure to host you, and well, obviously we will be continuing to talk over the coming months, but I'm sure our listeners were, you know, fascinated to hear about what you've been doing this past six or so years in the world of blockchain.
Great, thanks for having me. It was a real pleasure.